We ended our first episode by pointing to the mingled character of the comedy All's Well That Ends Well, how it just opposes bitter and sweet, good and ill. In this episode, we analyse that mingled character in depth and ask what kind of comedy it creates. For some critics and audiences, the play's mingled quality amounts to an unsatisfying mixture of genres. The play's bitter, ironic, disappointed notes make it almost as tragic as it is comic, resulting in a frustratingly ambiguous problem comedy or problem play, as it has been called. For other readers, those bitter elements make the play a more realistic and more moving representation of how human life unfolds. Julia Reinhard-Lupton, Professor of English at the University of California, Irvine, and co-director of the new Swan Shakespeare Centre, guides our discussion.
The term problem play has been used to describe this and other plays from the period. Its original application was to the plays of Ibsen, plays which dealt with social problems. And it wasn't really used to refer to works whose genre was unclear. So the problem of this play is not, is it a comedy or a tragedy, but rather something like, can a sustainable marriage be formed by unlike and unlikable persons? A lot of people really don't like Helena, and they like Bertram even less.
Some of the play's darkness comes from the elements of sickness and death. It opens with two deceased fathers and a sick king who is close to death. The Fool character, who usually adds humour in Shakespeare, offers unusually biting commentary about human life before and after death. He tells Lefeu of a master who e'er keeps a good fire, the Black Prince, sir, alias the Prince of Darkness, alias the Devil, the Prince of the World. Most people in the world, he says, are destined for the flowery way that leads to the broad gate and the great fire. But for many readers, the most unsettling element of this romantic comedy is the romantic couple. Bertram is one of the least likeable of Shakespeare's male leads. His snobbery about Helen's class, his cold-hearted readiness to abandon her, and his equal readiness to seduce Diana and abandon her in turn, can leave us wondering, not will Helen win him, but why should she want to? And many readers have qualms about Helen too, about how determined she is to win him, without any apparent regard for his feelings or desires, and about how that determination turns into manipulation and deception in the bed trick.
I always try to get my head into the space of these characters and read them with a little generosity. There are a lot of people in our lives who are headstrong and even manipulative, like Helena, or who are overly status conscious, like Bertram, and may be quick to lie and cover up their mistakes rather than admit to their mistakes in public. How do we learn to live with these people? And do we see any of their faults in us? Those are the challenges that I set myself when I read or watch this play.
The play itself recognizes that Helen and Bertram are flawed characters who need to heal and to change. This recognition is manifested in two prominent patterns of imagery in the play, imagery of medicine and imagery of spiritual grace.
There's so much rich medical imagery in this play, thanks to her training and also the acts of cure and care that are so central to the play's action. The play uses scenes of medical practice, the patient-doctor relationship, and metaphors of sickness and health and cure and care to look at both medicine itself as a profession and at human relationships and the social fabric as areas in need of healing. Helena herself has medicinal properties. Her presence can be healing. The clown refers to Helena as the sweet marjoram of the salad, or rather, the herb of grace.
The themes of medical cure and divine grace come together most visibly when Helen cures the king. of heaven, not me, make an experiment, she tells him. And the courtiers call the king's cure a showing of heavenly effect in an earthly actor. We're invited to see that same convergence of human skill and divine aid when Helen sets off on a journey that starts off as a religious pilgrimage and ends with her arranging her own pregnancy.
She's using her father's receipts, his prescriptions, and she also insists that God is acting through her. Grace is collaborative, especially in the Catholic tradition. There's definitely a Catholic presence in this play. Helena resembles a medieval saint and faith healer. The word modern is used in the play, but it also has a late medieval atmosphere, harkening back to a time when women could be faith healers and when sacred journeys could model and affect real spiritual change. She is the herb of grace, who can renew and reinvigorate the commonwealth through the kinds of prudence, courage, and new expertise that she represents.
Bertram's sexual desires are represented, like the king's fistula, as a kind of illness. When he pleads with Diana to sleep with him, he tells her, "Give thyself unto my sick desires, who then recovers." But could the bed trick possibly be his cure? Diana tells Bertram that he should be faithful to his wife, and Bertram responds, "I was compelled to her." He didn't choose to marry Helen, nor did he love her at the time. Some critics have pointed out that if Bertram were a female character, we might admire rather than condemn the character's choice not to have sex with an unwanted partner. And yet, Helen achieves her pregnancy by arranging to have sex with him without his choice or consent. How could this action heal what is wrong with Bertram or with their marriage? This is a question that the play takes quite seriously.
Certainly the weirdest and most controversial part of this play is what is called the bed trick. It makes modern and contemporary readers very uncomfortable because it involves one person having sex with another person without their knowledge or consent. So how do we get our minds around this? Well, I think first it's important to note that these bed tricks in Shakespeare are always executed at the expense of a male character who is himself trying to abuse or exploit another woman, in effect, to rape her. So one problematic but legally legitimate action, legitimate at least from an early modern point of view, is substituted for another clearly exploitative and highly damaging act. In the process, one woman who has been treated poorly by her legal husband gets to consummate that marriage. And she also not only saves the honor of another woman, but she's also safeguarding the moral well-being and legal standing of her husband. So there's a real moral elegance or economy, if also moral ambiguity, in this narrative solution. It would be great if Helena could somehow appeal to Bertram's better side without tricking him, right? Like, "Hey, Bertram, maybe you don't want to seduce and abandon this impoverished but virtuous young woman." But he's really besotted with Diana. And he has to somehow pass through the sexual act in order to come out the other side. Modern critics often focus on the element of deception here. But I think we have to be attuned to the element of mystery, mysterium, mystery in the religious sense. Somehow these two damaged, imperfect people need to encounter each other as absolute others, as unknowns. They have to undergo the most terrifying kind of intimacy, which is a blindfolded intimacy. And this experience in the dark somehow takes them to the other side of love, allows something new to commence between them. When Bertram abandons France for Italy, he says, "War is no strife to the dark house and the detested wife." Well, the detested wife, that's Helena, draws him into a truly dark house, which ends up being a place of mystery and renewal. Helena exits this dark house impregnated by him and holding the remedy to his own guilty conscience because she has saved him from destroying Diana. In Measure for Measure, the bed trick is called a repair in the dark. I love that phrase. To repair is to journey, return, or resort to a place. But to repair is also to mend, fix, or restore a thing. To attempt a repair in the dark is to undergo a certain blindness, take a moral risk, tap the other senses, accept a momentary subjective undoing. You wouldn't want to repair an engine in the dark. But a marriage? Maybe sometimes that's necessary. Marriage is a house with many mansions, and some of them are dark. There's a famous line in the play about life as a mingled yarn, good and ill together. And it then continues, our virtues would be proud if our faults whipped them not. Well, Helena's virtues in the first half of the play, which include the virtues of courage and prudence, are whipped by her faults, by her overreaching, by her failure to anticipate Bertram's response to her advances. And then Shakespeare completes the thought. He says, our crimes would despair if they were not cherished by our virtues. Well, that's Bertram, I think, right? Bertram would despair of his crimes, crimes against Diana, crimes against Helena, if Helena did not cherish him and actually prevent him from acting on his desires. It's really a wonderful set of lines in which the good and bad in each of us is then redoubled in the couple. You can feel Shakespeare working with the image of the mingled yarn, making it into a moral pattern traced by his characters both alone and together. They can only heal themselves by healing each other. And whenever you're healed by someone or something else, you are in the presence of grace, right? You're in the presence of the limits of your own doing, your own making, your own striving. Shakespeare always goes there. The dark house is the house of care, it's the house of grace, where you allow yourself to feel rather than see the other person.
As we evaluate the bed trick and what it might heal or repair, it's worth remembering, again, that Bertram isn't the only one who needs to change. The play presents Helen, too, as someone who needs to learn more about her partner if her idolatrous fancy is to mature into real love.
Everybody in the play seems to love and admire her, except for Bertram. And his own judgment is terribly skewed by class prejudice, his young age, and also his lack of control over his own destiny. But I think we should still take his reservations seriously. They're not nothing. I think we are meant to admire her pluckiness, her intelligence, her courage, all very modern qualities. But I think we're also meant to see how those same qualities prevent her from understanding who he really is. She calls her love a form of idolatry. It's still an infatuation that hasn't yet flowered into a real and lasting love. That project is ultimately going to have to include and acknowledge Bertram in some way, using his desires in a manner that does justice to him.
The bed trick may help open Helen's eyes to Bertram's needs and desires. It's possible, too, that it might open Bertram's eyes to possibilities he hadn't considered before, that his desires could find fulfillment in a marriage that he didn't initially choose. When Helen first sees Bertram after their night together, she refers to that night by saying, I found you wondrous kind.
Wondrous kind is really beautiful. It implies a delicacy and an intimacy and a concern with her pleasure and her being. There's a wondrous kindness that they're going to have to explore together, but which did take place in that hour that they shared together in the dark house. The play is about how you make marriage real. What do you have to understand and accept about the other person's darkest fantasies and deepest faults? What do you have to understand and accept in yourself? It's the comedy of trying again until you get it right, and learning how to forgive yourself and the other person when you get it wrong, ideally with the same life partner.
The final scene evokes at least the possibility that the marriage between these two partners will not, in fact, end well. Helen asks Bertram, "Will you be mine now you are doubly one?" And he responds, "If she, my liege, can make me know this clearly, I'll love her dearly, ever, ever dearly." Some readers see that conditional "if" as yet another instance of Bertram deferring and distancing himself from Helen. And her reply evokes the image of a final permanent distance. "If it appear not plain and prove untrue, deadly divorce step between me and you." These qualifications continue in the king's final lines. "All yet seems well, and if it end so meet, the bitter past more welcome is the sweet." Critic Jonathan Bate writes, "Those little conditional qualifiers leave open the door to the tragic world." For some critics, simply the suggestion of tragedy or imperfect happiness at the conclusion ruins the play as a comedy. For others, however, the play can alter our conception of what comedy ought to represent. Not unqualified or guaranteed happiness, but happiness that will be wiser and sweeter for passing through tragedy.
I think critics can ask too much from comedies. Because we identify comedy with romantic comedy, and romantic comedy with happily ever after, and everything has to match up perfectly, we then get disappointed. But comedy is supposed to be about the correction of vices as well as the celebration of virtues. So comedy has within its vision a very mixed portrait of human life.
The king's final line, "The bitter past, more welcome is the sweet," exemplifies another crucial pattern of imagery in the play, images of antithesis, of contrasting experiential and moral qualities. This imagery suggests that a very mixed kind of comedy may actually tell a truer kind of story, because human life itself is mixed and multiple. The Countess, for example, describes the painful passion of young love by saying, "This thorn doth to our rose of youth rightly belong." Diana also sees pleasure and pain as bound together in many experiences of love. "When you have our roses, you barely leave our thorns to prick ourselves," she tells Bertram when he asks her to sleep with him. And Bertram does abandon her after he thinks he sleeps with her, much as he abandoned Helen. Two lords comment on Bertram's honourable conduct in war and his contrasting treatment of women. "How mightily sometimes we make us comforts of our losses," says one. "And how mightily some other times we drown our gain in tears," says the other. "The great dignity that his valour hath here acquired for him shall at home be encountered with a shame as ample." Just as human experience mingles pleasure and pain, individual human characters mingle honour and indecency, dignity and shame, virtue and vice. But that doesn't mean that humans cannot grow or change or find some greater happiness with each other. In Shakespeare's comedies, the path towards healing and happiness must often traverse those darker spaces.
Even in his lighter comedies, like in A Midsummer Night's Dream, the young lovers come out seeing double. They're repartnered with their mates, but after a mix-up that has really exposed the tentativeness of attachments that had seemed so secure. The dark house of the bed trick is equivalent to the forest in Midsummer. These are dark spaces where lovers act out desires that threaten their relationships, but can ultimately make those relationships stronger by requiring new formations of trust. Helena has blindfolded or hoodwinked Bertram and is taking him through the fantasy of adultery and fornication that has taken over his heart and mind. Although the bed trick itself is not naturalistic, I think it still gets at something real about sexual passion, how it can interfere with our will and drive us sometimes to work through a fantasy in order to get out of that fantasy. I think we have to believe that Bertram can change and that Helena really is the herb of grace who will allow him to reform himself.
The play's title is sometimes taken to refer to the bed trick, a deceptive act with a favourable outcome, as if the title simply meant the ends justify the means. But Professor Lupton finds that there's much more at stake here than simply an excuse for a problematic act. All's Well That Ends Well refers to a whole way of regarding the mingled strands that compose human lives. When Parolles wants to excuse Bertram for fleeing France before consummating his marriage, he tells Helen that this want and delay is strewed with sweets, which they distill now in the curbed time to make the coming hour overflow with joy and pleasure drown the brim. Here is another antithesis in the image of making perfume. Flowers are bottled up for a time to distill them and to later create a pleasurable scent that will overflow with joy. The present moment is marked by want and delay, by frustration, but this present bitterness actually creates the joy to come. Parolles here accidentally captures another truth about our mingled human lives. The present moment doesn't disclose its full meaning in the moment. Time must unfold before the meaning of this moment becomes clear. A terrible present moment may be redeemed or made well by the new meaning it takes on in the future when we see where this moment has led.
I think so much more is at stake in the title. And I really think about it in terms of narrativity and the lifespan. Aristotle in his Ethics says that we can't really know if we've achieved happiness, eudaimonia, if we've lived a good life until we get to the end of it. And I don't think that means that if our final years are difficult, as they often are, everything before is for naught. I think rather he's thinking about narrativity, about the whole set of memories and expectations and experiences that we're continually composing and reorganizing in kind of the great scrapbook of memory as we move through life in concert with others, losing people, meeting people, remembering people. You don't know what the meaning is of the current moment until you get to a later moment and you get some of that meaning from other people, from how they understand an event or an action, how what you have done has impacted them positively or negatively. So it's not up to you to determine the meaning of everything. And you can't do it all at once. There's no survey, exit survey, that you can answer after each action because time will tell. And that's very much a perspective that Shakespeare develops. Comedy takes place in 24 hours. He can't work in that time frame. That's very constraining. He has to have that development over time. And so he goes beyond the comedy-tragedy distinction in search of these mingled yarns that are temporally complex, that are layered, that afford different passageways. And you're going to follow the yarn through the labyrinth in search of a meaning. And you can't just look at it from an aerial view and understand what that shape is. You have to trace it yourself. And you do that often blindfolded. And that's just very Shakespearean. Here's how virtue anthropologist Cheryl Mattingly talks about narrative in our lives. She says, narrative feeds projects of moral becoming, riddled by uncertain possibilities and informed by pluralistic moral values, concerns, and communities. I think that's very Shakespearean. This is a play which is pulled in different directions by different story types. The marriage plot, the buffa or jest, the king's cure, the saint's life, the bed trick, the pastorelle or lower class seduction story. And it's the task of the different characters, as well as the audience, to work at pulling those together into a dynamic whole, into an all, an all's well, into a mingled yarn that forms something. And when we're able to do that, it's the function of therapy, for example, it's the function of prayer, of meditation. When we're able to do that, we can reach some sort of wellness even when we're sick, right? Some state of psychic and social health. But that process is ongoing. It's a work, a labor, a project, to use a term that Helena herself uses. Hence the yet and the seems.
We'll further explore the play's perspective on time and how future outcomes may reshape the meaning of our mingled yarns in our next episode, when we look at three key speeches from Helen.